Washington County, and the first thing I need to do is apologize to the court for my citations to the record. As the court will note, in the appendix, at the bottom of each page, in the middle at the bottom, the page is numbered, and there is also a number at the bottom of the page on the right-hand column, which I don't know why it's there, and they match up through page 40, but I cited in my brief the page numbers that are on the right-hand side at the bottom rather than the ones who are at the bottom.
Does that impermissibly force us to come through the record?
I don't think it's fatal. I think it's stupid, but I don't think it's fatal, and I apologize to the court for doing that.
You're fine.
In this case, Mr. Hicks was arrested on March 12, 2015 for a DWI third offense within 10 years. He was read implied consent. The trooper believed he was intoxicated on drugs, and he took a blood test pursuant to implied consent.
Now, did he, factually, he consented to the test, did he not?
No, sir.
Well, they didn't hold him down and forcibly draw the blood.
No, but they read him implied consent.
I understand that, but he consented because of the implied consent law.
Yes, sir.
But he consented.
Yes, he impliedly consented.
So
because he would go to jail if he did not consent.
So isn't the issue here the same issue that Mr. Beeland raised in Birchfield versus North Dakota, whether that consent was somehow coerced?
No, sir, I don't believe it is, because in this particular case, the officer said on cross-examination that this test was given pursuant to implied consent, and I asked him if there was a search warrant involved, and he said there wasn't.
That is the act. The three cases consolidated in Birchfield,
yes,
Mr. Beeland, those are the facts in Beeland and the Supreme Court of the Supreme Court of the United States remanded for the question of determining whether the consent was valid or not, whether it was somehow impermissibly coerced, and then, of course, also raised the issue of whether, even if it wasn't, given that it was done pursuant to a then-valid state statute, whether exclusion was the remedy. That's footnote 9 in Birchfield.
Yes, sir. In this particular case, the defendant, a very docile person, never said, "I consent." He got in the back of the police car.
He never said don't.
No, he never said don't. He never said don't. But he was, in fact, faced with a jail sentence if he did not take the test. One other thing that happened was at the preliminary hearing, the officer testified that my client had not made any statements to him regarding drugs he took. But on that morning of trial, the officer said he found a sheet of paper that reminded him that my client did make a statement to him that he had taken those two drugs. He later, on cross-examination, said that may have been, he said, he takes those particular drugs.
You did not raise the search warrant or lack of a search warrant issued by way of written motion, did you?
No, sir.
Doesn't 1942, 266.2 require you to do so?
It does, but that was waived by the Commonwealth. In this particular case, there are four things that show that I raised it.
Is Appley here? Can they waive that?
Sir?
Can an Appley waive that?
I believe they can, and I'll try to explain why. First, we objected that there was no search warrant. We cited the Schmerber case, which was slaughtered by the court reporter to Scherner, but it was the Schmerber case, which is one of the most important cases dealt with in the implied consent case. And we also asked the officer about implied consent and the search warrant, and the judge said that he overruled the objection. And he noticed he preserved both arguments. So he preserved both of those two arguments.
They made two waiver arguments. One, that you didn't raise Birchfield with sufficient specificity, that the case at the Supreme Court dealing with and Schmerber, and I have no doubt you said Schmerber, that waiver argument. The second is the failure to file the written motion as required by statute. And so you were going to tell me why they waived that argument. Why did they waive that?
The statute in the last paragraph of subparagraph B allows the judge to allow you to file or to raise, it says to raise the objection at a later time.
So the Commonwealth can waive reliance on the statute. The Commonwealth can say, or by not saying anything, the Commonwealth can just say, we don't have any objection to hearing it at this time.
Well, and as this court always said, the Commonwealth, by not raising the objection, didn't allow the court to rule on whether I could raise the objection at a later time. So it's waived under 5A18.
The answer to Judge Payne's question is yes.
Yes.
But does the language require the trial judge to affirmatively waive it, or can he waive it by implication by simply ruling?
I think someone has to bring it up for it to be raised, and the Commonwealth certainly could have raised an objection at that point. I think the fact that the judge can make that decision means that the Commonwealth has to make an objection, because we don't know at this level how the judge would have ruled, and the judge was deprived of the ability to make that ruling in the trial court level. So it's our opinion that it's our belief that we did not waive with the manner in which it was raised. We did not waive with regard to that statute, because the Commonwealth failed to object under Rule 5A18.
Mr. Gallagher, I'm not too concerned about the time the objection was made, but I'm concerned about the scope and the sufficiency of the objection. While you can preserve for appellate purposes a case that's before the Supreme Court, you have to make the same argument to the trial court. You just can't wave it by and say, well, this case is pending, we'd like to preserve it. And I think your objection was very very short, to be generous. You just say we'd like to reserve this, but you never made the argument why.
Well, we did raise Schmerber, which is a Fourth Amendment case dealing with taking blood for a DUI case, and that Birchfield cited Schmerber, and the judge said he preserved both, and we also asked the officer the specific question
about
search
warrant. But you never objected to the admission of the test on that basis.
Yes, sir. We did.
On the basis that it was taken without a warrant?
Yes, sir.
I thought you just referenced Schmerber.
No, we said we also raised that objection at that time.
Raised what objection?
The objection to the introduction of the warrant, because the introduction of the certificate, because no search warrant was taken.
I think your objection is, and one other objection, I'm just raising this one, Judge, because it's in front of the Supreme Court right now, and I want to put it on the record, and that was that the test was given by implied consent without a search warrant being issued under Schmerber case. I'm just raising it.
Yes, sir.
How is that an argument, a legal argument, as to why that test is not valid?
I think by raising Schmerber, it makes it a legal argument, because Schmerber dealt with the necessity of a warrant, of a search warrant in such cases. And it, again, is the basis of the Birchfield case.
At page 15.
Okay. If I could go on to my next argument, and I only have 37 seconds left, so I'm going to be really brief on it. My argument is not on chain of custody. My argument is the fact that the statute requires the statement, specifically the statement, received, seal unbroken, seal not tampered with, that be certified. And Dr. Kuhlman specifically stated in his testimony that was all secondhand knowledge. There were no double checks for that. So that was the statement of the person who received the vial. And in the Bullcoming case, it says Kaler certified he received Bullcoming's blood sample intact with the seal unbroken, that he checked to make sure that the forensic report number and sample number corresponded, which is the exact same thing as happened in this case. And then the court goes on to say at page 660, these representations relating to past events and human actions not revealed in raw machine-produced data are meat for cross-examination. So that can easily be corrected by the Commonwealth by removing that requirement from the statute.
How do you distinguish it from Robertson versus the Commonwealth? Not every person involved, as long as you have the person who's actually making the scientific conclusion.
Because the statute in this case requires that certification. For instance, on the breath testing machine, I'm sure we all remember that it used to have that the machine had to be tested every 6 months, and that was certified to. Well, rather than have the person come from Richmond or Roanoke to testify to that every time, in special session, the legislature removed that requirement from the statute. And now there's a big black stamp over that particular area. And that's what the legislature can do here. They can relieve that requirement. But if the state requires it, then we're entitled to cross-examine on it. And I see I have 3 minutes and 16 seconds.
All right. Thank you. You may reserve the remainder.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I please the court, Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. First, on the first waiver, that is, you've already been through the limited statement of what the claim was. The reason why the mention of Schmerber is clearly insufficient is the Virginia courts have discussed Schmerber in Shumate and Rowley and have said that if we have the implied consent law, there is no problem under Schmerber, that in fact the implied consent law is sufficient to provide that consent.
But if you take the whole book, because it's in front of the Supreme Court right now, and I want to put it on the record, and that was that the test was given by implied consent without a search warrant being issued under the Schmerber case.
Right.
Correct. Now, given the reference to the Supreme Court case, and I know the better argument would be Birchfield is in front of the Supreme Court dealing with this very issue, but in context, is there any way to read that other than the implied consent statute is what is at issue? What's left of implied consent after Schmerber is what's at issue in the Supreme Court case. I mean, when you read that blind, you knew he was talking about Birchfield and whether implied consent was still good.
Yes, Your Honor, but the trial court judge had no idea what he was talking about. He doesn't say because of the possibility of a criminal penalty. Well, he says just because of Schmerber, the Supreme Court is thinking about the implied consent. There's no explanation to the judge that my argument is this, that in fact the reason why the Schmerber is no longer good law, I mean the cases interpreting Schmerber are no longer good law, is because the Supreme Court is considering a case where the possibility of criminal punishment for a refusal may void the otherwise valid implied consent. There is this is at a place where he's also objecting to the certificates on confrontation grounds. So then the judge deals with those issues. He deals with the confrontation. He deals with the conformity with the statute. He doesn't deal with the Fourth Amendment claim, mainly because there's no mention of the Fourth Amendment anywhere in the record. And I think that that's the problem, is the judge, the issue was not presented to the judge. Nobody looking at that who wasn't fully familiar with the case law before the United States Supreme Court at that point. And, of course, Birchfield hadn't been decided yet. Birchfield wasn't decided until after sentencing. So we've got a case where he refers to it, but, you know, the idea that everybody would be familiar with what that case is all about merely because he suggests it's before the Supreme Court. And don't forget, this was not a motion to suppress. It was part of the objection to the certificate on other grounds. So the reason why 266, I think, is important here is that the Commonwealth never had any opportunity to consent.
266 can be waived by the Commonwealth.
It can be, Your Honor, but not if he doesn't. If the Commonwealth doesn't know what it is he's waiving. There was never a motion for, at that time, for a hearing of any kind on the suppression. All he knew was that he raised an objection without mentioning the Fourth Amendment.
Isn't it not unusual, at least in jurisdictions that I've been confronted with, where the government and the defendant's counsel will agree that any preliminary motions and the like will be taken up on the date of trial and waiving any seven-day notice because of that? Isn't that typical?
I know that does happen, Your Honor.
Okay, so why wouldn't we accept counsel's representation that that's what happened here?
Well, I think the only thing that he said happened here was that the Commonwealth didn't raise an objection under 266-2 at the time that he made his...
But typically, and you're an experienced counsel, and I mean, you know this, if you have a situation where the government's not ready to go forward because the defendant has not filed something timely and hasn't complied with the requirements of the statute, the government's response is, Judge, we're not ready to go forward on that today, and we don't want you to take up the issue because it hasn't been done in compliance with the statute.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think looking at that objection...
Are we in kind of a logical circle?
Yes, Your Honor.
The only way that the Commonwealth could be said to have waived its right for written notice of a Fourth Amendment motion under 19.2, 266.2, if it was raised sufficiently by the appellant. And Fourth Amendment isn't mentioned anywhere in here, so we would have to imply that the Fourth Amendment issue was preserved. If we find that it wasn't sufficiently stated, then 266.2 applies. If we find that it wasn't sufficiently stated, by definition, you couldn't have waived it.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's it.
But I'm a little bit concerned about your argument, right result, wrong reason, and the Commonwealth doesn't have to specifically raise an objection based on 266.2, because clearly the trial court could allow the motion to be heard at a later time.
Yes, Your Honor, if the court knew what the motion was.
So, yeah, I understand that, and I'm not unsympathetic to that, but I don't buy the argument that because it wasn't raised, we can still invoke 266 on appeal, because clearly there's an additional factual finding that the trial court would have to make, and that was whether there was good cause.
Well, let me then move on to what I think is probably the best disposition of this point, is that the exclusionary rule cannot properly be applied here.
On the merits, Mr. Hicks is bailiff of the three Birchfield defendants, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The principle set forth in Davis and other cases is that when the police conduct is objectively reasonable, it's not appropriate to file, to exclude the results of their activities. Here, at the time that the police did what they did, they had binding Virginia and federal authority that an implied consent law permitted them, without any constitutional difficulties, to extract the defendant's blood. And that's exactly what they did. What they did was entirely consistent with the Virginia State Court's interpretation of Schmerber and with the interpretation of Schmerber in other courts, that in fact the implied consent law was sufficient to satisfy the obligation, the need to get around a warrant. That with the implied consent law, a warrant was not necessary. So the officer's behavior in this case was fully consistent with constitutional practice at that time. And on Davis and other cases we've cited, it would be inappropriate to sanction the officers by excluding the evidence when they, in fact, did exactly what they were supposed to do.
That was our holding in Freeman.
Yes, Your Honor.
Dealing with the constitutionality of a state statute is called into question.
Yes, Your Honor. And on several of the constitutional issues, they applied the same principle. If, in fact, it was constitutional, now when they did it, becomes unconstitutional later on, the police are not punished with the exclusionary rule because of that fact.
In footnote 9 in Birchfield, the Supreme Court remands and says there are two questions that the court will have, but the North Dakota courts have to answer. Whether the consent was voluntary or was it impermissibly coerced by the implied consent statute, which seems to be the issue we would have here, and then whether exclusion is appropriate under Pine versus North Carolina. Would we have to remand to resolve either of those questions to the trial court, or is the Supreme Court's remand essentially dictated by either the need for factual findings, or is it because
I think we have
dual sovereignty that they're deferring to North Dakota to make that determination?
I think you have complete authority to rule on that without a remand, because the issue was what the officers did consistent with constitutional practice at that point, and there's no dispute about that. You know, that in fact, at the time they did it, before Birchfield had come down, the state law permitted this action, and I think it doesn't require any additional evidence of that, and I don't know how any evidence could affect that. But the point is that what they did was legitimate at the time they did it, and that's not going to change. Now, with respect to the confrontation clause, I put a good deal of the voir dire from Dr. Coleman in my brief, because it points out what we have here is a very different situation from the claim that he didn't know what was going on in the lab and, in fact, was not an appropriate person to sign the certificate. As that evidence points out, he was fully aware of what was going on. He reviewed the work. He assured the proper procedures. He completed the certificate. Now, in the Bullock-Cumming and Robertson, he is, of course, entitled to confront the analyst who completed the certificate. Of course, he had that in this case. And the requirement is satisfied if the witness is competent to testify to the truth of the statements made in court.
But I think the argument, as I understand it, is that there is a prerequisite to the admission of the certificate, and that is there be a certification that the vial was sealed when it was received. That's a statutory requirement.
Yes, sir.
And that the person that did that, and that it was, or the person that could certify to that, was not present in court, subject to cross-examination.
Yes, sir.
So that seems to be quite different than testimony concerning the result.
No, Dr. Kuhlman testified about all aspects of the receipt and control of the samples.
Did he testify about the vial being sealed?
Yes, sure. He testified
from his own personal knowledge, though.
Well, no, he knew that it would be sealed when it came in, or else the analyst would make a note of it, and it would be that the had
that's
several qualities.
That would be an assumption, and those get you into trouble sometimes.
Well, I think he control had authority to do everything necessary, because he said, pointed out. Let me say what he said when he was talking about why he could complete the certificate. He said at the end of the examination, he completed what was called an examination. He had to inspect all the data, that is the printouts, the information that's coming from all the various instruments, check the chain of custody documentation, check to make sure all the quality control procedures were followed, because it was all documented.
But he testified as to what the normal procedure is, the requirements of it, and his conclusion that everything was followed was because the procedure requires somebody to document if something wasn't.
Yes, Your Honor. Everybody had to document whether or not
So he testifies that this is the procedure, but his conclusion is based on his assumption that everybody followed the procedure and that the procedure, somebody didn't miss a step.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. And
all the steps were met because I assume all the steps were met.
No, Your Honor. He says the steps were met because everybody documented that the steps were correct.
But doesn't the statute require that certification on the certificate of analysis in order for that certificate to be admissible?
That may well be, Your Honor.
Okay. The money quote in Bullcoming is when the state elected to introduce, in this case the guy's name was Kaler's, certification, Kaler became a witness and Bullcoming had the right to confront him. So
when the state elected to introduce this certification in order to meet the statutory requirement, whoever opened that became the witness, and that witness was not present.
I'm not. I think one of the concerns maybe is that there were two claims mixed together in the trial court. That is the confrontation clause and the conformity with the statute. In on brief, the defendant argues only the confrontation clause. That is that he was entitled to question anybody who had anything to do with the events in the lab after the blood came into the laboratory. And I think
the statutory argument from the trial court was waived in the appellate brief.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think what he was talking about is that he had a right, basically, contrary to Bocoming and Robertson, to have everybody who had anything to do with the certificate.
But I think his argument is on the confrontation clause, but it's the confrontation clause argument is relevant because of the statutory requirement. If there were no statutory requirement, we just say, it's really not that important because of the presumption of regularity in the handling of exhibits by public officials. We'd say there was no requirement that whoever could certify this be present to testify. But because of the statute, then it becomes a confrontation clause issue.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, but I think the case law has basically been that if, in fact, nobody there is going to be able to testify to everything because they, tested the blood for different drugs, different people were involved. So calling everybody who had in any way been involved would have involved 3-4 analysts at least. But here we have a man who supervises every step of the procedure, makes sure that everybody who has to check off to assure the chain of custody, everybody who has to check off that, in fact, the sample was properly packaged when it came in, has done that.
Well, that argument is we can ignore the Constitution because it is too expensive or burdensome to comply with it.
Well, I mean, in part, that's true. I mean, and that's one of the arguments is that, it would be nice to have everybody there, but the burden on the Commonwealth would be insufficient.
Well, I think the answer to that is a constitutional convention and to change the Constitution, not to ignore the founders' plain language.
Well, Your Honor, I think what the cases have said that there's a compromise, that in fact, if the man who completes the certificate can tell what happened, what the procedures were, that is sufficient. And because my time is up, I request the decision below be affirmed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Murphy.
Just 4 points I want to raise. The first is, I believe Justice Scalia's answer specifically to your question is that it would not cause a backlog in the court. He said that in an earlier decision about the confrontation. Also, thank goodness for Lexis
What burden do you have as counsel in the context of the consideration of the statutory requirements to put the government on notice that you want certain individuals there to enhance their case regarding the change?
I filed an objection to the certificate in advance, Judge.
Mr. Gellman, can I ask you to address Mr. Murphy's argument that suppression is not an appropriate remedy, particularly under our decision in Freeman versus Commonwealth?
Well, I think it is an appropriate remedy. It is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And I looked on Lexis while we were in a pause here, and this court has previously decided in Rosenborough versus Commonwealth, 55 Virginia App 653, that the reading of implied consent is coercion. In that case, the individual was on private property and was read implied consent. And this court, as I recall, excluded the certificate because they said it was not.
I may be wrong, but didn't that case go to the Supreme Court?
I don't think so.
All right, maybe I'm wrong. There have been so many.
But this court decided
but,
that.
But that's not the issue. The issue is how could we possibly be deterring police misconduct when what they did was specifically authorized by statute in our previous case law? That's what Freeman says.
I don't know. I guess you have to go all the way back to Mapp versus Ohio and whether cases are applied retroactively, and cases are, in fact, applied retroactively if they're still on appeal.
But in Birchfield itself, in footnote 9, regarding the client, the defendant looks the
yes,
like your client, they specifically say you have to go back and make the determination whether under our decision in Hine versus North Carolina, exclusion is the appropriate remedy. And, of course, that was an officer acting under a belief that he was following a state statute that at the time was would have been
yes, sir.
Believed to be constitutional.
And, again, I would say under the Rosenberg case, this court has already made the decision that it's coercion. If I could just a couple of quick points. The main thing I am challenging under Bullcoming is not the individuals who did all the testing. They've got double checks. And as I said, the main thing in my brief that I'm challenging is the person who accepted the vial, said it was sealed, and said that it was not tampered with. That is a statutory requirement. I point that out in the brief. And since it's a statutory requirement, that person has to be there for cross-examination. The other thing is, in brief, Commonwealth says that you have to look at my client's testimony because my client said that he did, in fact, take the drugs. I would point out that he said that during the penalty phase. He did not take the witness stand during the guilt phase of the trial, so the jury could not have considered that. And I don't believe that this court can consider his testimony at the penalty phase for purposes of the guilt phase.
Thank you very much for your argument. Mr. Gallenbach will greet counsel. And our next case on the docket is Wilmer versus Commonwealth.